How you feel about this economy, it turns out, depends a whole lot on where you work. What the economists who work in the White House think on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today, the 19th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You are not ever going to find from a Republican administration or Democratic the annual economic report of the president on a bestseller list. But, and it is usually worth spending some time with the thing, doorstop size though it is, 700 pages this year, 705 actually. It's worth spending some time with the thing to get a sense of what the White House is thinking about this economy, where it's been and where it is going. And what the Council of Economic Advisors, which actually wrote the report, is thinking is, hey, things look pretty good thanks to the tax cut. So we got Marketplace's Mariel Seguera. She covers taxes for us. We got her on the phone for a little context. Hey.
Hi.
So let's do the top line thing first. The big thing: gross domestic product, overall economic growth. What is the Council of Economic Advisors saying on that?
Yeah, they talked about GDP growth from the end of 2017 to the end of 2018. It was 3.1%. Mm-hmm. And then they actually made a guess what growth would have been if Congress had never passed the tax law. They came up with 2.2%. So the gap between those numbers, 2.2%, 3.1%, that's how much the tax law has supposedly boosted our economy. You know, that's obviously a projection.
Right.
We can't go back in time. Nobody knows for sure. But, you know, economists make estimates all the time. That's reasonable. There were some other things going on in that same time period that could have boosted GDP. Oil prices went up, which led to investment in the U.S. oil industry. Investment is a part of GDP. Mm-hmm. We also got a big spending bill in 2018. That's a part of GDP. Economists told me, though, you know, you would expect almost any tax cut to boost the economy somewhat in the short term.
Well, and that's the key thing there, right? Because the predictions in the out years for this economy are substantially slower than what the White House says. So I want to ask you about what Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, the guy whose name is on this report, he pushed back against this talk of a sugar high, right? What did he say?
Yeah, he said, you know, people say this is a sugar high, that we had 3% growth, but that it's going to fade away soon. He said they don't think that's going to happen. Economists disagree on this. I think that's in part because there are short-term and long-term effects of a tax cut. You know, in the short term, a lot of economists say that they do think that the effects will fade away this year, next year, so we'll sort of go back to normal. But some of the investment that we've seen, it doesn't happen immediately. It takes years to know the real effects of it. And also it takes years for things like factories to come online. And so that we could see years from now.
Right. Which is also another thing Hassett likes to say, that factories are coming back because of this tax law, even though we haven't actually seen that yet. I do want to ask you one last thing, Mariel, on the way out. We got 30 seconds. How are we, the reading public, to take this report? Because it's written by the president's people, and it is, in essence, a political document, right? Political document.
Right. They are economists, but they're also highlighting the stuff that they feel aligns with the president's agenda.
All right. Mariel Seguera in New York for us on taxes and today on the White House Council of Economic Advisors report to the Congress, actually, is what it is. Mariel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Just because there aren't enough ways to buy stuff in this economy right now, Instagram says it's going to launch in-app purchase and payment functionality to make it that much easier for its billion users to see and click and then buy. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has the latest in the social retail wars.
In my Instagram feed today, there was a cool desk lamp, a rugged phone case, and skincare products, all mixed in there with my friends' pets and vacations. They were ads, but weirdly, I didn't mind. Ariel Pardes covers personal technology at Wired.
Part of what is so brilliant and also so insidious is that people find the targeted advertisements and the products that surface in the Instagram feed totally irresistible.
Instagram says 130 million people a month try to shop through the app, but until now its interface for doing that has often felt clunky.
Putting in your information over and over on a small mobile device actually was a big inhibitor for people to actually make the purchase.
Vishal Shah is Instagram's head of product. Now the company will process the payment with stored details and take a cut of each transaction. He wouldn't say exactly how much. Facebook, which owns Instagram, doesn't have the greatest reputation for data privacy. Tom Forte from DA Davidson says users may be wary, so an ad will have to feel like it's curated, something shoppers welcome.
And it is in no way some sort of data play that feels invasive to a consumer.
Instagram isn't trying to be the next Amazon online retail giant, says the company's Vishal Shah, but to carve out its own niche for people who browse and shop more casually, kind of as a hobby.
Maybe the same thing you would have done when you would have gone with your friends to a mall and checked out the latest fashion.
A mall? What's that? I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
I get a lot of shoe ads in my Instagram. I'm not quite sure what's up with that. You click on something once and it follows you around. Wall Street Today might as well not have even rung the opening bell, is how unchanged things were. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The American visa system is complicated. All the different categories and eligibility requirements and who is allowed to do what kind of work. The H-2B visa is designed to let hotels, resorts, restaurants, and landscapers hire seasonal workers when there aren't enough American citizens to take those jobs. Those employers, though, complain the government doesn't grant nearly enough H-2Bs, and with the next application period set to begin in July, they want the current limit of 66,000 H-2B visas raised or done away with altogether. Marketplace's Andy Euler checked in with one industry that depends on those H-2B workers.
On Maryland's eastern shore, crab season is less than 2 weeks away. Aubrey Vincent's getting ready. She runs the crab wholesaler Lindy's Seafood with her dad. Lindy sells to markets, restaurants, and has its own brand, Mary Ellen Crab Meat. She hires H-2B workers from Mexico and Central America to crack open freshly steamed crabs, extract the meat, and deliver the product.
Without this H-2B program and the seasonal workers that come year after year, our plants would be out of business. I mean, we just don't have the people here to do the jobs.
Her staff of mostly H-2B visa holders will start work on April 1st. But things were different for Lindy's last year. Vincent applied for 100 temporary work visas, didn't get any. The way the H-2B process works, you either get all the visas you're looking for or none.
We weren't sure what we were going to do because it essentially eliminated about 40% of our business, 40 to 50%.
In the middle of the crab season, the government released an additional 15,000 H-2Bs. Lindy's applied for and got 70 workers, enough to stave off disaster. If you're a business, you just never know how the whole H-2B thing is going to go. Bill Seeling is executive director of the Chesapeake Bay Seafood Industries Association. We reached him at a seafood conference in Boston.
Every year you're totally in the dark as to whether you're going to be in business that year or not.
And he says the limit on H-2B visas makes it tough for crab plants to line up contracts year after year.
So if you're running a big organization, a supermarket chain or something, and you want to have crab meat consistently, you're going to go to a company that you know is always going to be able to meet your needs, not say, well, I'm sorry, this year I don't have any workers, but call me next year and I'll probably have workers again.
Seeling wants to get rid of the H-2B visa cap altogether. For now, the only thing in the works is the Department of Labor's plan to switch to a lottery system. Labor says it would be fairer and more orderly. To some employers, though, a lottery hardly seems fair. Boston immigration attorney Peter Kramer says all random selection does is avoid another Department of Labor website meltdown.
It keeps the DOL computers up, but it doesn't help the employers because they're still going to have that 1 in 3 chance of actually getting the visa.
Kramer would also like to see more H-2B workers in the country. Groups opposed to expanding legal immigration feel the opposite. Daniel Costa at the Economic Policy Institute opposes expansion for another reason. He says H-2B workers don't get a fair shake.
It's a captive worker program. They have a visa that is owned and controlled by an employer. They can't switch jobs easily. If they get fired, they become instantly deportable.
Costa says H-2B workers should be able to get a green card or apply for citizenship. He also thinks employer claims of worker shortages are overblown. Aubrey Vincent at Lindy Seafood says she would hire all American workers if she could, but there aren't enough willing to accept seasonal work. Vincent did manage to get all 105 visas she applied for this year, but there's no guarantee for the crab season after this one.
The pie's only so big, and unless they provide some type of, let's say, returning worker exemption or an increased cap, something along those lines is going to need to be done because there's still more demand than there are visas.
The federal government received about 100,000 H-2B visa applications in January. and awarded $33,000. It'll hand out another $33,000 to the lucky Visa winners this summer. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One of the ways, and there were a lot of them, but one of the ways that China became the economic powerhouse that it is was by taking in a lot of the stuff the rest of the world didn't want, paper and plastic and metal scraps, and then using that as fodder for its own manufacturing base. They took out recyclables for decades, and we bought the products they turned all those scraps into. But about a year ago, that all changed, and the global recycling industry has not been the same since. Javi Lieber wrote about it for Vox. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I confess that I did not know the system whereby which I put all my recycling out at the curb at night on Tuesdays. I did not know that system was broken, but you tell me it is.
Yeah, the country is in sort of a crisis moment regarding our recycling, not just glass, but plastic, paper, everything.
Well, so tell me how it used to work then. I mean, when global recycling as an industry was working, what was happening? Where did this stuff go?
So the global recycling industry is a $200 billion industry, and it spans the globe. If you think about your milk cartons, your water bottles, your cardboard boxes, your plastic containers, all of that gets collected, and then it gets sold in bulk to countries like China, Malaysia, India, Vietnam. But really, for the last few decades, China has been the main country that has been importing recyclables and then selling them to small mom-and-pop factories and then turn them into cheap exportable goods like shoes or sandals, little knickknacks. And that really contributed to China becoming this manufacturing giant.
And the catch, of course, is now the Chinese have decided they don't want to do that anymore, right, with the changes in the Chinese economy.
So when China was becoming this manufacturing giant in the late 80s, early 90s, they were capitalizing on cheap labor. But now the Chinese government doesn't want to be considered the world's garbage dump anymore. Mm-hmm. The government is veering away from low profit sectors like waste, and they're actually focusing more on tech. On the tech industry. And as a result of this, now the global recycling system is just totally crumbling. And plenty of cities in the U.S. are struggling to figure out what to do with the recycled goods.
Right. So the question then is, when I put my trash can out, as I will do when I do tonight, and it's got all my recyclables in it, what are municipal and for-profit, I suppose, recycling firms and organizations in this country doing with all of that scrap?
It's kind of turned into a panic. So some cities are actually burning the waste. Hmm. Other cities are burying it. Some are dumping it into landfills. But right now, like the recycling system is just completely and utterly crumbling and has to be reshaped.
The attentive listener here will note that if we are more mindful in our consumption, we don't have to worry so much about recycling, right?
That's the direction that a lot of these bigger companies are going to. So over the last year, you've seen companies like Nestle, Unilever, Procter & Gamble. I read a piece, even Trader Joe's is trying to figure out what to do, you know, to curb back on plastic. But there isn't current infrastructure to figure out like how to send it and where and when, because we've been so reliant on China. It's also interesting that other countries like India and Malaysia are now trying to follow in China's footsteps and ban foreign trash. So, you know, you have the United States struggling, but you also have Germany and Ireland who are and Australia who, you know, they're just their whole recycling system was built on these countries who now no longer want their trash.
Right. It is indeed a changing global economy. Recycling is the topic of the day. Javi Lieber writes for Vox. Javi, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Coming up,
the typical worker in the United States faces an annual risk of death of one chance in 10,000.
This is grim, but that is an economic calculation that actually gets made, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 26 today, about a 10th percent, 25,000 to 887. The NASDAQ up 9 points, a 10th percent, 77.23. The S&P 500 down less than a point. Call that flat. 28.32. Fox Corporation debuted on the NASDAQ today, and it named former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan to its board. Fox Corp is the parent company of Fox News, which is the company that was left over after Disney bought 21st Century Fox's film and television assets for $71 billion. If you're still following me, Fox Corp clicked down 3.25% today. Disney off 2.75%. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today's global trade tidbit comes via the Wall Street Journal. The paper reports U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin are going to Beijing next week for another round of trade talks. Then the main Chinese delegation is coming here the week after. The causal factor, of course, is President Trump's tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports and his threat to do more. But amid all the tariff news, it is easy to forget there are plenty of other import duties being imposed right now, including the ones on steel and aluminum that went into effect about a year ago. As we have said many, many, many times on this program, American consumers are the ones paying those tariffs, and that in turn takes a toll on the people running American businesses. So for today's installment of our series, My Economy, a voice you have heard here maybe before, someone whose business depends on imported steel and who has now had to deal with nearly a year of those tariffs.
My name is Sam Desai. I'm the vice president at RM Metals in South Plainfield, New Jersey. When it came about on March 8th, they made the announcement, and it started on March 23rd. We were shocked to see it. We had a vessel with metal on it that instead of arriving on the 22nd, it arrived on 23rd because of weather. And we ended up paying $70,000 in tariffs at the time, and many customers did not want to pay it. The whole conversation was, how do we share the tariff? And that's where, you know, our margins basically are gone. I've talked about the tariffs with family members who hear about the tariffs and are all worried about it. I find myself working more than I was before. I'm not sure if this is how the new business model is, that you have to work, you know, more hours, keep thinking about different factors and issues out there. But I try to do my best to separate the home life and the work life. But sometimes it's very hard because of the regular flow of how things have become today. Definitely, I do come in on the weekends and whenever time permits to work. And I do miss certain events if I have to. I was in India just recently and, you know, I could not visit all my family. Instead, I was, you know, visiting customers and suppliers. And, you know, that's kind of sad that we go so far and because of timing, we come back and not have the time to visit our own family members.
Sam Desai, trying to get by in this economy. This series only happens because of you, you know. So please share your story with us. You can do that at marketplace.org. We're going to take a very slight turn to the grim side of the dismal science right now. You could even say the slightly ghoulish side, because we are going to talk about the value of human life. I mean, subjectively, it's priceless, of course, but the reality is that economists and government regulators and businesses do put a dollar sign on life in a very real way. There's a number denominated in dollars for the cost that businesses face weighed against the benefit in lives. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor has the story of how we came to put a price tag on life.
In 1949, the Soviets tested their first atomic bomb.
President Truman's dramatic announcement that Russia had the atom secret.
The U.S. government started developing plans in case there was a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. They asked a think tank called RAND to help find a cost-effective strategy.
Their advice was to fill the skies with numerous cheap propeller planes, overwhelm the Soviet defenses.
Spencer Banzeff is a professor of economics at Georgia State. A lot of planes would be decoys without nukes, and a lot of planes would get shot down. But the few with nukes would make it through.
The Air Force hated it. They hated it. They wanted to know, what about the lives of all their pilots that would be lost in the attack? And RAND didn't have an answer. They said, well, we didn't take account of the lives because we didn't know how to put a number on them. That didn't go over well.
That plan was shelved, and for decades after this, government officials and economists inside and outside of RAND wrestled with this problem. How do you put a number value on a human life?
They said that life is too sacred to value.
Kip Viscusi is a professor of law, economics, and management at Vanderbilt. In 1982, this question of valuing life made it all the way to the vice president's desk. Government bureaucracies were fighting over whether a potentially life-saving regulation was worth the cost.
For the first time, dangerous chemicals in the workplace would be required to be labeled, indicating what to do if the worker was exposed.
That would probably save lives, but it would cost companies millions. And it all boiled down to how to value the lives that might be saved. One agency thought it was worth it, the other didn't.
And I was brought in to figure out who was right in this dispute.
Viscusi settled this using an idea from an economist called Tom Schelling, whose work was influenced by that debacle over nuclear war plans. Viscusi started by looking for places in the economy where people were forced to make trade-offs between dollars and risk of death, and he found them in the workplace.
Back when I did this analysis the first time, the typical worker in the United States faces an annual risk of death of one chance in 10,000.
Some jobs are more dangerous than others.
We can isolate how much extra wages workers are paid for those risks.
Using today's numbers, they basically find that on average, workers earn about $1,000 a year more for taking on a 1 in 10,000 chance of dying on the job. Now, what if you have 10,000 of those workers?
Then on average for that group, there would be one expected death.
So if you add up a little risk of death and a little risk of death and a little risk of death, you get a death. And if you add up what everyone was paid to take on all those little risks of death, you get a number.
In total, we would be having to pay the workers $10 million for the one expected death that would occur to their group.
That is what is called the value of statistical life, and it is the dollar value assigned to a theoretical human life.
$10 million.
Economists admit that people kind of recoil when they hear about this value of statistical life approach. Economist Spencer Banzeff again.
People understandably think that it has to do with valuing a specific person's life. We're not trying to put a dollar value on individual lives. If a six-year-old girl falls down a well, we're not going to ask how much is she worth. We're just going to get her out.
But we do put a value on risks to life. We pay for safety features. We demand more for dangerous work. So the value of a statistical life is technically a measure of life based on how we value risk to life. And it lets you compare, say, the cost of a regulation in dollars to the benefit in probable lives saved. That regulation, by the way, back in the 80s about the labeling hazardous chemicals, it went ahead. It was worth it, they said. Kip Viscusi.
Every major government regulation that involves mortality risks is assessed using the VSL. Transportation regulations and environmental regulations.
So the value of statistical life is basically a way to value a life without actually valuing life itself. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, and I swear I am not making this up. Marielle was telling us about the big White House economic report out today. Well, I direct your attention now to Appendix A, page 624. And again, this is real. It's a list of acknowledgments and contributions. And down at the bottom of the page is a paragraph labeled Interns, which reads, student interns provide invaluable help with research projects, day-to-day operations, and fact-checking. Interns during the previous year were, and then it lists them. It's about a paragraph, as I said. And it's a list that includes John Cleese. You know him from Monty Python, I'm sure. J.T. Hutt, as in Jabba the Hutt. Catherine Janeway, also known as Admiral Janeway from the Star Trek franchise. Aunt May from Spider-Man. Peter Parker, who was Spider-Man. Steve Rogers, a.k.a. Captain America. Jon Snow, you know nothing, Jon Snow. And Bruce Wayne, Batman. All of them, apparently interns for the President's Council of Economic Advisors this year. You know nothing, Jon Snow. Winter is coming, gang. Winter is coming. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 26 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 9 points. A 0.1%, S&P 500 basically flat today. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Steve Bion, Danielle Chiriguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Heathcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.